On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
We are delighted to welcome back to On the Bookshelf Chuck Collins, who is the author of The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. It's from Polity Books, and you can check their website, politybooks.com. We had him on the show before with his first book. Chuck was the heir of the Oscar Mayer fortune and then decided not to hang on to it, or at least his share of it. And that's part of the story, but it also buys him gravitas when he's talking about people that hide not just a little money here and there in a sock in their drawers, but vast sums. So Chuck, thank you so much for making time to rejoin us on the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We want to say up front that this is not an attack on capitalism, and this is not a case of a few smart people hiding 10 bucks. We're talking about people that basically have trillions of dollars from one kind of way or another. Some of them inherited the money, but we're also talking about major criminals, international criminals, aren't we?
Yeah, and I think I appreciate you saying that right up front, because to me, this hidden wealth system really undermines healthy capitalism, and it prevents us from kind of healthy economic growth and other activities. So it's, and the United States more and more is becoming the destination for some of those illicit funds, because we have some weak links, if you will, that make it easier to hide money here than in other places in the world.
For example, there are two states that give a ridiculous amount of, shall we say, laxity, or just, they're known as being tax shelter states. That's Delaware and South Dakota, right?
That's right. Yeah, Delaware has historically been a place where if you want to incorporate a limited liability company, you don't have to ever disclose who the real beneficial owner is. And that's not just to protect privacy. I mean, that's secrecy from law enforcement. So what we find is, a lot of bad actors will create limited liability companies in Delaware. And our goal, what we advocate for is what we call the library card level of disclosure. If you're going to create a corporation, it's just like you get a library card. You have to say who you are and where you live. And that should be true for bank accounts and shell companies, and we should know who's buying what around the corner.
Now, speaking about buying, there are all kinds of ways for these companies, and you talk about something that most of us have never heard of an office whose job it is to protect any kind of access to knowledge about any of this money, and to figure out a way to basically work around having to pay taxes, having to be accountable, or anything else. And we're not just talking, again, about people that inherit vast fortunes. We're also talking about people who steal vast fortunes from, say, Angola and Haiti and places like that, which we know happens, sadly enough, on a pretty regular basis.
Yeah, what all those folks have in common is what social scientists call there's a wealth defense industry. They are tax attorneys, accountants, wealth managers, people who run these family offices for very ultra wealthy people. And just to be clear, we're talking about people like with $30 million all the way up to the billionaire class. You need to have a pretty high level of money to be able to sort of hire these specialized services. And when you're really wealthy, you literally bring all those services in-house and create this family office that manages your financial affairs. And inherent in their mission is hiding money, reducing taxes, and passing it on to the next generation. So they're also sort of building these inherited wealth dynasties, which are starting to walk the earth and take up more political power.
And there are more and more of these dynasties, oligarchies, all the time, right?
Yeah, I mean, the important thing to understand is this has really taken off in the last 15 years as more, and even during the pandemic, as more wealth has sort of funneled upwards, both globally and nationally. There were probably 1,000 family offices in 1980. Now there are 10,000 family offices catering to the very, very wealthy globally, with 1,000 in London alone. So it's a really a growth industry.
Now, we're not just talking about people that inherited money from their great-grandparents or something like that, although there certainly are those people. But we're also talking about people that set up fake foundations to basically use as money laundering outfits. We're talking about people that make somewhat token attempts at donations to, what's the phrase you use, over-endowed places like Harvard University. In other words, not a place that needs the cash desperately, like an Appalachian State or something, but a place that's just floating in cash already. But you know, they have a historical connection to that university, so let's just throw a couple of million more, and they'll name a building after you, and you can write it off, right?
Yeah, no, I think what we're seeing is not only is there this whole hidden wealth system, but even philanthropy, you know, private foundations, that the super wealthy billionaire class is creating these private foundations that kind of become extensions of their power and influence. And let's not forget, we as taxpayers subsidize the creation of those foundations. You know, if for every dollar a billionaire puts in their private foundation, you and I are chipping in 3/4 of that, 75% of that in lost tax revenue. So we're subsidizing these private foundations. And it becomes part of the wealth protection strategy for the very rich.
Now, I'm going to tell a story, and I'm going to be very careful about it because I have an inside track to this story, and I don't want to get anybody still who's living in any kind of situation. But there was a congressman who was very well-to-do in this area, very influential, and toward the end of his career realized he had a lot of money in unexpended funds that was donated to him for influence buying, of course, but also ostensibly for re-election campaign, and he wasn't going to run for re-election. What to do? Well, he set up a foundation and put someone in his family in charge of that foundation and paid them a salary to manage the foundation. And the foundation was basically, let's save all this money and not have to give it back to the donors, and let's even convince more people to donate money to me to try to buy influence while I still have an opportunity to wield it, and I can retire with a big, fat, cushy nest egg, even bigger than the one that I was going to get from being a congressman.
I mean, this is, unfortunately, we're seeing abuses. The whole idea here is you give money to charity, it should go to the food bank, it should go to Appalachia State, it should go to, you know, real recipient groups that need the money. But private foundations only have a requirement that you pay out 5% a year, and you can use that for overhead. So all this is the situation you're describing. Family members are hired, the foundation acquires property, it has meetings in very nice locations, you know.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, all the overhead money is chewed up, and there's very little money trickling out and flowing to recipient groups on the ground. That's the kind of unfortunate abuses that we're seeing with private foundations and charities right now.
And this is a very easy place for bad people to launder their money, donate it to a foundation, and then the foundation hires them to do something, and before you know it, money that they got in human trafficking or drugs or terrorism, whatever, now they've got clean money.
Yeah, I mean, it's a form of reputation laundering, too, sometimes.
Hmm.
So, we saw this with the Sackler families at the Purdue Pharma. You know, here are these folks, they proactively tried to addict millions of people to opioids, resulting in destruction of lots of communities. And they have a whole charitable giving arm that gives to the arts and, you know, makes them look like generous and virtuous people. So sometimes philanthropy can also be a distraction from, you know, where did this money come from? How was it created? But yeah, a lot, you know, the basically there's a bunch of really complex tools, foundations, but also trusts, shell companies, offshore tax havens where money is moved in and out of bank accounts in the British Virgin Islands or Cayman Islands. And what the wealth defense industry does is pretty much use all those tools to layer up and mask who who the real owners of the wealth are. So at the global level, there's some estimates as high as $36 trillion, almost 12% of the world's wealth, is now hidden in one of these shell systems.
Mm. We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Chuck Collins, the author of The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. It's from Polity Books. Chuck is senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., where he directs the program on equality and co-edits inequality.org. Previous books include Born on Third Base and, with Bill Gates Sr., Wealth and Our Commonwealth. You have a story in here which, I got to be honest with you, when I read it, it kind of made my blood boil. This is the Blue Hippo Swindle. You want to kind of give us the short version of this?
Sure. And this is, you know, one of the ways that the hidden wealth system, it's not just about avoiding taxes and making the rest of us pick up the bill. It's also about protecting grifters and people who rip off their customers. So there's this company, Blue Hippo, that had late-night television ads. They would say, hey, you know, is your credit damaged? You can still buy a computer through Blue Hippo. Just call this 800 number, and for $40 a week, you know, you'll build up and you'll have a computer. And so people would call up, and they would give them their bank account number, and every week they'd take $40 out of people's bank accounts. But then eventually people realized, hey, that computer is not coming. Where's the computer? It was a complete swindle.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the authorities at the state level went after the Blue Hippo company. When finally Blue Hippo was cornered, they went bankrupt. Then they went after the kind of wealthy guy who started the whole thing. And he had moved the funds. He'd gotten his lawyers and wealth defenders to help him create a trust, an asset protection trust, in the Cook Islands, which is, I think, are somewhere east of New Zealand. You know,
right.
This little rock-splattered seagull haven. You know, basically, this little country has created these trusts to, you know, siphon money. So,
right.
Even the Federal Trade Commission could not arrest this guy, get the money back for these consumers. Some $15 million was swindled from mostly working class people who just needed a computer, you know. So it's an example. And he lives in Florida, you know. He has this, I looked at his Facebook page. He's putting up pictures of puppies. He's got a Lamborghini. He walks free.
Yeah.
You know, think about all the people who are in jail for lesser offenses. And here's a guy who, and it's because of this wealth defense industry that allows grifters like, you know, the Blue Hippo founders to avoid responsibility and accountability and subvert the law.
The story about the theft of the wealth of Angola is not particularly surprising, and sadly enough, not particularly unusual. This has been something that has plagued the small island of nation of Haiti, which is consistently the most the poorest country in the entire Western Hemisphere. And one of the reasons is they've had a series of elected leaders who took all the money that was donated through the years to rebuild infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, put it in offshore accounts, and then decide to retire. And there goes all the money that was given by well-meaning people to help out poor Haiti, and it's stolen again.
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes we think of countries like Haiti or countries around the world as poor, but I think we should understand these countries were plundered.
Yeah.
You know, they have a tremendous human capacity and natural resources, but that money has been taken away. And the sad story is this same global system of wealth hiding is what enables wealthy elites in countries all over the world, no one is accepted here. You know, if you're from a wealthy elite in a Latin American country, you probably bring your money to Miami, mm-hmm. and you run it through some offshore accounts, and then eventually you bring it to the United States and you buy up luxury real estate or something like that. And the case in Angola was the daughter of the dictator of Angola, you know, obviously lined up all these sweetheart development projects and siphoned to billion dollars out of Angola into bank accounts in Europe. And she couldn't do it alone. She got help from PricewaterhouseCooper, the Boston Consulting Group, Deutsche Bank. These banks that and financial advisors were part of the enablers. They're part of they're like the getaway car drivers for the theft of these countries. And we should be holding them to a greater account.
New ways that people are hiding vast amounts of wealth is buying artwork. And tell us about these very special places that help them to avoid paying taxes when they buy stuff and paying taxes when they sell stuff, because it stays in this kind of like a duty-free zone at an airport.
That's right. Yeah, sometimes when these luxury pieces of art change hands from, you know, one billionaire sells their Monet painting to another, the painting is sitting in a free trade zone art building, you know, and I actually went and walked by and looked at one that was in East Harlem. There's one in Delaware. There's several in other countries. Basically, it's like a free trade, no nation zone. It's like this. So when they buy and sell art, it's not subject to any national taxes. But just to back up, the big picture is these folks have so much wealth. I mean, if you think about just the global billionaires, you know, with, you know, $12 trillion of wealth, what do you invest it, you know?
Right.
It's kind of like the too much money problem. Where do you park it all, right? Well, okay, you got some in the stock market, and you got some over here in bonds, and now you probably got some cryptocurrency. But you also want to put it in land and real estate and real things that maybe hold their value in case the markets go down. And so luxury real estate, land, art, jewelry, all these things suddenly become they're commodities for investors to hold their wealth. And luxury real estate is a huge one because people, mostly in the coastal cities, there's huge investment in these luxury towers that no one lives in.
Right.
They're just like wealth storage units, just like you can rent an extra garage bay down at American Storage. You know, this is wealth storage for the super rich.
And see, I grew up in Daytona Beach, and I remember when they started building the condominiums and such right on the beachside about the time that I came off to school in Alabama. And what ends up happening is, first of all, they say they're at 100% occupancy, but no one lives in them. If there were people living in them, they would buy gasoline, they would buy groceries, they would pay taxes, they would contribute to the community just by being members of the community. But if they're empty, then all it does is keep anybody who wanted to live there from being able to afford it, and it drives up the property values anywhere in proximity. And this is what you were talking about, too, when people buy downtown apartment buildings, say in Birmingham or Huntsville or Mobile or New York City or something, and then just use them for like this, a free trade zone. Here, buy this. You don't have to live in it. Just own it. And it runs the prices of everything up in the area and depresses the market, because depresses the economy, because there's nobody living in them to expend money in the community.
No, we're seeing this happen all over the country now. The hollowing out of neighborhoods.
Yeah.
That there's no one living there. You know, pity the poor person who needs to borrow a glass of milk for their baking, and there's nobody in the building. You know, it has a harmful effect. There might be a positive effect. Maybe those buildings are paying property taxes, but as you say, it's driving up the cost of land. It's hollowing out neighborhoods. If you have a neighborhood business that depends on the foot traffic of people in the neighborhood, well, you don't have any customers. They're all just investors parking their money. So it can be very harmful to the fabric of a community.
Now, there are people who donate money to actual charities that are helping people, but most of the time, the kind of high-profile donations that people like to make are to symphony orchestras and museums and things like that, but they don't necessarily donate them to homeless shelters or homes for indigent women who find themselves pregnant or things like that. Those sort of things are generally taken care of by churches. What these mega funds take care of is seems to be their tax bill and their reputation.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, as more giving comes from the super wealthy, you know, maybe 30 years ago, you know, the United Way, the March of Dimes, we saw these, you know, broadly supported charities, low and middle income people chipping in to help meet community needs. The wealthy are different in terms of their giving. First of all, about a huge amounts don't even go directly to charities. They go to private foundations and donor advised funds that have no payout requirement. So there's sort of a wealth hoarding effect. And then, as you say, you know, there's sort of elite charity priorities. You know, high arts, culture, not the needs, the urgent needs, the food banks, the, you know, the most in need organizations. That's not entirely true. You will see, you know, generous gifts and works from wealthy people that really do make an impact. But more of that money goes to indirect things that actually benefit the wealthy. You know, they're the symphony that they're part of, or the arts organization that they directly benefit from. So, I think we should be skeptical of billionaire charity as the solution to so many big problems we have.
Now, you do have some good news, that there are steps that are being taken, that people are starting to realize, and people in positions of authority in the government and so forth are starting to realize that some of these things are fixable, or at least manageable, or at least worth trying to manage. You're talking about the Corporate Transparency Act, for example. Tell us a little bit about these things that you've been working to promote and to have put in place to stop these excesses.
Yeah. Yeah. One really good piece of news is that at the end of 2020, Congress did pass this Corporate Transparency Act, in part to address the Delaware problem that you and I were talking about. And that requires corporations to disclose who their real beneficial owners are to the Treasury Department. So the whole idea of an anonymous shell company would go away. There's some weak links in that law. It doesn't include trusts and partnerships, but we can strengthen that law. So that's a huge step in the right direction, and it came about because Republicans and Democrats and independents and law enforcement really stepped up to say, we need these tools. We need to be able to track and follow the money. So that's good news. There's a whole push to strengthen the Internal Revenue Service's ability to follow the money of the super rich. You know, President Biden has proposed investing $80 billion over the next 10 years on enforcing the existing tax laws, which are almost porous and optional for the rich. So that's a really important step in the right direction. And then there's now a lots of opportunities to come together with European Union and England to sort of have treaties to have greater transparency and disclosure. What are banks doing? How much are corporations paying in each country? So there's more international cooperation. So I think it's very possible that we might see some of this hidden wealth system shut down in the next couple of years, which would be good for so many reasons.
Well, now you mentioned before the enablers, the people who make their living by making these kind of tax dodges possible and profitable, the members of the WDI, they are subject to the jurisdiction of nation states. Is there anything that can be done to convince them of the error of their ways?
Yeah, I think that we can put more pressure on their professional associations. I think we can encourage them to come forward and share some of these tax hiding dodges. A lot of what we know about this hidden wealth system is because of disgruntled whistleblowers who have leaked information or have talked to me while I was writing this book and explained how the systems work. And there's even some of them are saying, well, we're going to help members of Congress draft laws and provisions to shut down some of these trusts and, you know, kind of funky business transactions that have nothing to do with real economic activity. So some of those wealth defense industry people are helping us fix the system, and that's a good sign that there's kind of a crack in the wall, if you will.
To me, that's a huge step in the right direction, because they really, they're the insiders. They're the guys that know not only where the bodies are buried, but where all the money is buried. I just have this vision of Scrooge McDuck in the Donald Duck cartoons, of opening this bin and running in there and jumping on his piles of coins and stuff, not because he needs the money, but just because he likes the feel of it. I that was an image that stayed with me all the way through this book, I must admit.
Yeah. Well, maybe, was it Bob Cratchit, Scrooge's assistant? Maybe
right.
Cratchit is going to, tell the authorities about some of those dodgy transactions, because, that's essentially the poor old Cratchit. You know, he's the one who's doing the work and the accounting, and he's not, benefiting in the same way from all this hidden wealth. So
right.
Yeah, maybe that's part of the fix.
Yeah, maybe the Bob Cratchits of the world are the ones that need to step up. And as you're saying, they're starting to do that. Some of them helped you in your research for the wealth hoarders. Is there anything else that we as voters can do about this?
Well, I do think, in the next couple months, there's going to be a big debate over, how do we fix our national infrastructure? How do we pay for COVID relief? And I think, as much as I have to say, none of us love the Internal Revenue Service. The Internal Revenue Service is really important right now. If they're not enforcing the existing laws, the estimate now is $1 trillion a year is being avoided. And that was the commissioner of the IRS a couple of weeks ago testifying. What was the tax gap between what the current laws should be raising and what's actually coming in? And this is not, low-income people or moderate-income people. It's the super rich who are gaming the system,
right,
along with maybe a couple hundred global companies. There's like 54 companies we found last year that paid no taxes, profitable, hugely profitable companies, paid no corporate income tax.
Oh, my gosh.
So enforcement is probably the first step, and that's where, letting your members of Congress say, I don't think there should be a special set of rules for the super rich and a couple hundred corporations. We should have a tax code that works, that everybody has to pay their fair share. Small businesses and low-income taxpayers shouldn't be picking up the tab for wealthy freeloaders. And I think communicating that, and when people say, well, I don't like the idea that the IRS is going to have more power, saying, well, the IRS has been decimated in their ability to follow the money, and that the super rich are laughing all the way to the bank about how porous the system is, the oversight. If you don't have a cop on the beat, the criminals will just keep playing the same old game. So we gotta invest in enforcement for starters.
Well, Chuck, it's absolutely, like I said before we started, I was alternately thrilled to find out these things and horrified to find out these things. But the more that people find out what's going on, the more that they can support the efforts to try to rein this in. So thank you very much for getting with us. Do you have a website we can go to for more information?
Yes. Inequality.org is a good website to find out more sort of about these inequality issues. And actually, we have a website for the book called WealthHoarders.com, and there are even some kind of cool little informational videos and more information there. So inequality.org and wealthhoarders.com.
Chuck Collins, our guest today, his new book, The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. It's from Polity Books. And once again, check out the websites inequality.org or wealthhoarders.com. Chuck, thanks again. It's always a pleasure to get a chance to talk to you. Pulling the Band-Aid off this very, very difficult situation with the wealth hoarders and the wealth defense industry. Once again, check inequality.org. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and on your favorite podcast. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.